Metallica, here they come, the kings of metal!
Hey, this is Jay Weinberg from Slipknot, and you're listening to Metal Up, your podcast.
Welcome to Metal Up, your podcast. I'm Ethan Luck.
And I'm Clint Wells.
And folks, we have an insanely exciting episode. We have none other than Johnny Z on the show.
Johnny Z, Megaforce Records. Most listeners of the podcast and fans of Metallica will have heard of him. He is the dude who got a copy of the No Left to Leather cassette, loved it, knew he had to be, you know, somehow involved with the band, brought him to the East Coast, signed him to their first deal, recorded Kill 'Em All, put him on tour with Raven. And in this episode, he sat down with us from his home in Florida, gave us a rundown. He's got a book out called Heavy Tales. And it came out last year, but he's released the audiobook too. And we are going to be giving away two of those via our socials. So go check out the socials to get involved. Ethan, you want to tell them all the lovely socials we have? We have all the good socials, by the way.
Oh my gosh, you guys aren't going to believe this.
Because there are a lot of socials to choose from, but we have the good ones, I think.
We have the good ones. We have Twitter. We have Instagram. We have Facebook, speaking of the good ones. We're on YouTube, Clint.
Wow.
Can you believe
it? Unbelievable. YouTube, huh? Stitcher, Spotify.
We're on Stitcher. Everywhere. Anywhere you listen to the podcast, you'll find us. Anywhere, any social media platform you're on, minus TikTok, we're there.
Well, you know, John was so sweet and so cool. He told us so many stories that are in the book. A few things he told us aren't in the book. And there are a few things in this following conversation that I didn't even know about.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're not going to do a lot of housekeeping today. So we just want to let you know that you can support us on iTunes by leaving us a positive review. And you can support us on Patreon. You're going to hear a commercial for that. It's patreon.com/metalupyourpodcast. We did get several new patrons this week, and we want to shout them out as usual.
Per usual.
We got three this week. We want to thank Danny S., Luke S., and our good friend Namarta increased her pledge. Really means a lot to us. We're going to give you the clap. We're not going to give you the clap, honey. Please, we're just going to clap.
Oh, please, don't do that, honey.
It really means a lot to us at this time. Keeps us excited about Metal Up, your podcast, and we'll leave that there.
I just think everyone needs to go either get a copy of his book or download the audio book, wherever you listen to that kind of stuff. I finished it today on a drive home from vacation, and I can't recommend it enough. He's a no BS kind of guy, and listening to his story from his own mouth is truly, truly an awesome experience. And there's so many things in that audiobook that I had no idea about, you know, even after doing this podcast for 3.5 years.
Well, here we go. Without further ado, we bring you the legendary Johnny Zazzula.
Master! Master!
All right, so John, here we are. Thank you so much for being here on Metal Up Your Podcast. What an honor. What a treat to talk to you, legendary in the Metallica pantheon. And we will have known a lot about what's going on with you. Of course, the book's revealing and tells us a lot. Everyone should go get the book. We're giving away two copies of the book, so thanks to your publisher for helping us do that. The question I thought of, you know, when this started to get rolling is like, what was the impetus to write a book now? Like, why now? Why the book?
Well, I was still managing Venom 2 years ago, Venom Inc. And it was keeping me a little busy in the end of my days in the music business. And then I decided to retire dead stop, nothing, no advice, no nothing. And I basically was sitting around for 2 months retired, losing my mind. And someone told me a story about me that was totally untrue. So I said, you know what, maybe I'll just tell the story the best I can.
Get it right.
With whatever limited memory I still have left while I have it, you know?
What's the story you were told about yourself that's not true?
Oh, I don't remember. It just, somebody was told something that wasn't correct, and somebody went nuclear on him.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And the guy said, you're going all Johnny Z on me. And I said, what the hell is going Johnny Z on me, man? I never lost my temper. I may have lost my mind. but I didn't lose my temper. No, I kept it cool, I think. I think I did.
Well, I finished up the audiobook today on my drive back from a very socially distant vacation my wife and I took to the woods. And, man, if it was that story that turned out to be untrue that was the catalyst for you wanting to write this book, you did a hell of a job, man. I really enjoyed listening to it.
And
Well, you're welcome, man. And there were so many things in there. You know, I mean, obviously, our podcast is based around Metallica. And, you know, there's so many things that we think we know because we've been doing this for, you know, 3.5 years. And listening to your book today, it's like, wow, there's so many little details that I never would have thought of or I never even knew that were so fascinating and were told so well by you.
Thank you. I really appreciate hearing that. That's cool.
You know, for someone like you who has an amazing story to tell, how does someone like you get linked up with a publisher or someone to help you write the book? You did the audiobook
yourself. Well, the publisher I never went for. I didn't want anybody to tell me how to write the book. I didn't want anybody to tell me I'm illiterate. I didn't want anybody to tell me I should write it like a Rhodes Scholar. I wanted to write it in Johnny Z. And I basically didn't want to be involved with anybody telling me what to do. That's why I had Megaforce Records and I worked for myself my entire life in a DIY atmosphere.
Mm.
So we said, let's publish the book ourselves. So the book was written, everything about it is all DIY through the management company, Crazed Management, which used to be Metallica's management company.
Yeah.
Way back when. And the audiobook, however, came at a later time when somebody who I knew in the audiobook publishing business, just as a fluke, approached me to say, hey, and I said, hey, back. And it was like, what are you doing now? And I said what I was doing. And he goes, did you think about making an audiobook? And I said, I even tried to do an audiobook. I did that myself, but it came out terrible. Oh, guys. Marsha, my wife, heard the book and said, Johnny, there's no way you're going to do this. You know, there's bad and there's awful and it sucks. So, you know, we just didn't put it out. I even sent this to some friends and I asked them their opinion and they said to me, Johnny, you just can't do it. So I went to a publisher. He basically gave me the resources and told me to go into a real studio with a real engineer and a producer. And we spent 2 weeks on this audiobook.
Wow.
Well, there was a lot of editing. My voice goes in a few hours.
Right, right.
It just doesn't last.
I'm sure people don't really think about what's really involved in that, like just reading and orating and your voice goes. And I imagine that you've got someone trying to encourage you to keep it sort of like the same level, the same energy. So I can see how that could be more time consuming. I might take that for granted having never done it.
Well, there's other things too, like make sure you have the same mic setting
tomorrow
that you had the day today.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Right. You know, and you had yesterday. Make sure everything is at the same levels and make sure your voice has the same vibe when you come back.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right, right.
Believe it or not, I lose it all the time.
Right.
I lose it, especially when you're reading your own words.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, what a trip.
You know, and I tried to tell it, not read it. I don't know. If you heard the audiobook, and, you know, I told it the best I can.
Well, I'm proud of the product. I think you did a fantastic job, man. And speaking of the DIY approach to the book and the audiobook, I mean, I think from what I understand about your whole story in this book is that, I mean, that's how you started all the way back to, you know, rock and roll heaven, your record store that was in the corner of a flea market, you know. You know, with you and your wife just, you know, buying picture discs and rare imports and, you know, trying to find stuff that people in that area wanted. I mean, you guys did it from the ground up and I think that's in your blood, man. And that was the only way you could do this book.
It's the only way. I'm a real spoiled, rotten kid that's 68 years old today. You know, I couldn't have anybody tell me what to do and where to put the box. And where to put the check, you know, I just
right.
I just can't I just don't do it. And then when someone yells at me because I'm always doing something wrong. If you hear my dog, what can I say? They're always part of the interview.
Oh, you're all good. We love dogs.
It's all right.
I just couldn't take criticism. So, and if people criticize me, like for my book, I know I did my best.
Right.
It was me. I have me to blame. You know what I'm saying? That kind of thing. I live with that.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, but I just don't like working with having other people tell me what to do. It sucks, man.
So what was like? What was it like at that time in that part of the country starting a record store? I mean, is it difficult to start a record store? What's involved even with that?
Well, here's the whole thing, guys. I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
I really didn't know what I was doing. I love my metal, you know?
Yeah.
I said, if I like Angel Witch, someone likes Angel Witch. If I like Raven, somebody likes Raven. If I like Venom, someone likes Venom. If I like Motorhead, hey, man, someone likes Motorhead and Scorpions and Sabbath and all that. And I don't see any record stores selling that stuff. So I'm going to go to England and get it all and bring it here where it's happening.
That's a smart move, man. I mean, because there was definitely a demand for it. I know that in the early chapters of the book, you talk about, you know, you and your wife, you know, not necessarily getting as many customers as you were hoping for or selling these imports and stuff like that. And there's that one moment where you talk about, you know, banging your head against the wall and kind of getting like, you know, the divine intervention happened. And all of a sudden your attitude was just keep moving forward.
Well, guys, you know, I talk about divine intervention a lot of my life. I'm probably very spiritual and I'm very grateful because if you know me, like I mentioned in the book, you can't believe this all happened to me.
Right.
I'm being honest with you. I had all the right answers. I knew all the things to do. I was driven by the force of the Lord. I have no idea what to say. I'm insane. But I knew the answers. And I believed.
Yeah.
I had faith in Metallica.
Okay. Speaking of that little band, how did that... So from the tales we've been told throughout our fandom... You know, it all starts with you getting a copy of the No Life Till Leather demo. How did that tape get in your hands? What are some of your thoughts about the first time, you know, your first listen through? It obviously blew you away. You know, bring us into that place.
Well, it's all in the book, but I will say this.
Mm-hmm.
Someone brought that into my house, a customer, into my shop, Rock and Roll Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
They brought it into the store. And I don't play demos unless I took them home and played them because most of them stank. And I never heard of Metallica. I had no idea who they were. But these people said, Johnny, we know you. You've recommended music to us all our days here. You're always right. I'm telling you I'm right. Put this tape in the cassette player and listen to it. Now, I listened to it through broken speakers. You know, I didn't have much. But the second I heard, I don't remember what song was first, but I think the mechanics put me in the hospital. Yeah. You know, and on the MAB tape, I think it was live from the MAB, there were two cassettes. There was a version of Am I Evil, I think,
mm-hmm.
that I'm just trying to remember. But I think that also was like pretty sick. Whatever it was, I was so blown away by the music that I didn't know what to do. I was left speechless and I wanted to be part of it. I was throwing concerts in the area. I had 12 vacant spots for opening bands. And I said, I could get Metallica to play every one of those spots.
Yeah.
You know, opening up a Venom, Rods, Vandenberg, Twisted Sister, and the height, you know, selling out clubs to the end of the walls. But clubs that hold 2,000, the Fountain Casino in New Jersey.
You did the right thing, man, by jumping on that demo. And I think you mentioned the book that within the hour, you're running to the payphone to call the number that's on the cassette, which I believe was Lars's number at the time.
There was no phone in the store. There was no such thing as cell phones at the time, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So I took some change out of the drawer, and on the back of No Life to Leather was the name KJ Dort. And I called KJ, and KJ basically put me in touch with Lars Ulrich, who called me that night at dinner. And he also wrote a letter introducing himself and the band to me. A very professional letter, I must admit.
Yeah, that's cool. Awesome.
You know, I still have that letter today. Where, I don't know. But I have it
somewhere.
Somewhere. That's the one thing I held on to. That became the conversation where I offered the boys 12 shows in the Northeast. They knew who I was because the word was out that there was a madman bringing Raven and Venom and Anvil to the States.
Hmm. That's awesome.
And how did you do that? I mean, you love these new wave of British heavy metal bands from across the pond. Are you just looking up their management? Are you calling their managers, writing letters?
Well, the thing you got to do is look at what you got to work with. And what I had to work with was a record from Raven, for instance, and on it said Neat Records. I found out who ran Neat Records. I called him up. I told him what I wanted to do. He told me how much it would cost. And I said, oh, my God. And Marsh and I figured out how we're going to raise it and get him over here.
Yeah.
And we did. The same thing with Anvil.
It's amazing to think about you both doing that pre-internet. The amount of work to generate to actually find all this information, get a hold of the people, follow up, of course, raise the money, then follow up
just
with getting
the phone
them over
bill.
Here. Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. Long distance calls are no joke back then.
Calling Europe at $20 a call in San Francisco. Oh, my God, man. And we had no money. When I say no money, I mean no money.
So what was Marsha's vibe when you're getting all these big ideas that would, of course, end up paying off big time for you and for all of us? Was she looking at you like you were nuts? Or was she generally supportive? I mean, that's a big thing to ask your partner, right?
Marsh is a strange, strange woman. Marsh is a strange, strange woman. And she was very, very supportive of everything that I ever did. And I explained to her as I was running out of the store, the flea market, to go to the payphone, that I have to have something to do with this band. I must get involved with this band's life, career, future, everything. And Marsha basically, you know, just made sure I had enough change to make a phone call and go overtime if need be, you know?
Yeah.
So she was really supportive. That's so awesome.
She never doubted me. And when she did, it wasn't really, it was a miracle. Everything I'm telling you, it's incredible just how it all came together. One of the stories I talk about is like we have the successful show at Anvil and sell out the place. 800 people never heard of Anvil in their life, but they came because we had so many customers in the store.
Yeah.
And they wanted to feel this new metal. And we get back from the store, from the show, the most glorious night. It was our first show ever. Sold out. Everybody's saying this was the greatest. Get back to the house. It's all dark. We didn't pay our electric bill.
Oh, man.
So I had to get the power back on in the house. I mean, that's what Marsha lived with.
Right, right. Amazing.
And she wasn't, I mean, she's an intense woman. You wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of Marsha Zazula.
I don't.
No.
You would not.
There's some great stuff you tell about her in the book, you know, of her just busting her butt. Like when you're doing other things, she's driving 2 hours to go pick up all these imports and grabbing records that weren't on her list to bring back to the shop and, you know, doing all sorts of things with the shows to make things happen. And you definitely more than convey not only what a supportive wife she was during all this, but also encouraging and also a very hard worker to help maintain it all with you.
Well, I had to say thank you.
Hmm. Yeah.
The book is a love story too. Right. And there's a big thank you in there to a lot of people, especially Marsha, especially Metal Maria, you know.
Yeah.
There are people who I'm
still,
have
I'm
really...
still looking in the book for you to thank Metal Up Your Podcast and Clint Wells, but maybe that's maybe that's in a chapter later that I haven't read yet.
Hey, you want to know something? This is a very good interview, guys.
Hey, thank you.
For part
very
two.
Good. I'm very comfortable.
Good, good.
It's late at night and I'm kicked back.
Good. That's a high compliment. Well, so do you remember anything about the first conversation with Lars? What, you know, you got this little Danish kid. You're connecting him as the drummer. Anything
well,
in particular?
But you got to realize, and I don't know if you could feel it, but do you know what, with all you do with Metallica, do you know what punk is? What a real punk attitude is?
Sure, yeah.
You know that thrash is not just a music, it's a way of life, it's a way
Absolutely.
Of being?
Absolutely.
And this was my first contact with thrash in its life form.
Hmm.
I can't explain it to you. It was religious. This was punk attitude personified. They walked into my house. They met me. The guy who was going to promote them didn't give a shit. Saw my bar. Then, may I help myself? And it wasn't, could I pour a drink? It was like, which bottle do you want to take with? They were really thrashers. They came to the record store and they were just wild, crazy guys. And they're very different now.
Yeah, right.
But I'm sure it took a long time to slow down that burning craziness that they had when they were young.
And you can hear it on all those records too, especially Kill 'Em All. Everything you're describing is, you can hear it clearly in the album.
When Kill 'Em All was being produced in the studio, it was really funny. You know, they really trusted us and everything was going fine. And then all of a sudden, James calls me and he goes, hey, John, they're telling me the record's finished. And I went and I listened to it. It sounded like an Allman Brothers record.
Really?
Great leads, great vocals. But I mean, thrashy, but you know, that heavy chunk. And I go to James, I go, what happened? He goes, he never let me put in my parts. And wow, when he did, transform the whole entire album.
So was he talking about Paul Curcio when he's talking about he never let me put my parts in? Is that
the
producer, right? So that's kind of how what that made me think of is just how green everybody was. They're just coming out there. Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit too. I was curious, so you hear No Luck to Leather, you got to work with this band, you talk to Lars, you write your letter, you've got 12 shows or a bunch of shows. How long before that phone call and those shows were they showing up in New York and crashing at your house or New Jersey or wherever it was?
Well, they were crashing at my house the second they got there.
Right.
But you have to realize that I had Raven in my house at times, Ample in my house, Venom in my house, Metallica in my house. Sometimes they all were there at the same time.
Wow.
It was Castle Megaforce. Plus, I had every tape trader and their grandmother come by smelling it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you name the guy who has the biggest podcast or whatever in the country or running whatever record company, they're all sleeping on my floor in those days.
Yeah. So, what was your first impression of the boys?
Madness. I felt I made a mistake. I didn't know if I could harness this energy.
Right. Okay.
You know, I didn't know that I could. I felt that I could. But after talking to Lars a little bit, and Cliff, it started to come together.
I would imagine when you first saw them live up there, too, one of the first shows you put them on, that probably changed a lot, too.
Well, Metallica started off a sloppy band, you know.
Right.
Very sloppy, but amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing, because the more sloppy they were, the more intense they were.
Yeah.
And James, man, he was holy. He's like a holy man up there. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, he's pretty intense.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
He knows what to say. He shines.
Very commanding. He can command an audience and make you give a shit and pay attention. What was there anything that you noticed, like, from that first meeting and they're crashing at your house? Any tension with Dave? Because, you know, Dave would soon be replaced by Kirk on the making of the album. And were you honing in on any of that, or was that a surprise to you?
Well, Dave, the first time we met, we all went to the flea market, and he was throwing a ball over the front of the flea market where all the people came out, and, you know, just trashed. Mm. And I said, I don't know. Is this right? I don't know. Do I accept this? I don't know. What did I get myself into? Is this crazy?
Right.
And then it continued with everybody, actually, and Dave, not just Dave, the intense alcoholic frenzy throughout the entire time we were together. But when they went on stage, it all came together pretty intensely, man.
Yeah, right.
It all came together. And Dave, as sloshed as he ever was, I always used to say, man, you know, I don't know when they used to come to me, but they used to say, you never know what you're going to get. But on stage, he always was right.
Were they confiding in you even early in that they were maybe thinking about making a change in the position, or were they just not talking much about that?
Well, they were afraid to talk to me about it, I think, at first, because they didn't know what I was going to do.
Right.
Was I just going to send them home, or...
Because for them, you were a big break for them. A guy's interested in putting on some shows, bringing them to the East Coast for the first time, maybe even going to sign them to their first record deal. So they were maybe scared of losing that.
Well, I don't know what they were. They don't show signs of fear, but it could be true.
Yeah.
They probably figured at least they were better off with me than without me. And as far as Dave went, they did talk to me about Dave, but I just said, look, going forward in the big picture, with all the that's going to be invested and put into them physically, financially, mentally, everything, it may be better if they had a stabler unit.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that they did the right business decision for themselves.
Were you aware of Kirk Hammett? Were you aware of Exodus?
I was aware of the name Kirk. I was told he was really, really good. And I was really shocked, because by the time I got there, the day he got there and they were rehearsing already, he already knew all the leads and everything.
Right, right.
So wow. When we went right away to do some of the shows that Dave was going to do, he was right in there.
Says a lot about Kirk coming in that prepared, really taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he came in. He was a young kid, man. I thought he was like 17 when he came there.
Right.
You know, I thought he was this little kid.
What about first impressions of Cliff?
Cliff was a darling. I loved Cliff, really, by the way. I loved everything about Cliff. He talked to me all the time. You know, I smoke herb. He smokes herb. So I had someone to smoke herb with while everybody was drinking. So we got along infamously. Even Red Knight, I always tell the story, read nursery rhymes to my daughter, Ricky, you know, because the house was so full of noise and madness.
Hmm.
Just to let her help her go to sleep at night.
Amazing.
Wow. That's so cool.
Great guy. And
great
I
memory.
Was with Cliff the day before he died, because I was out on that Anthrax Metallica tour that day.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I said goodbye to him as they left England. And I happened to be with Cliff that day. He was the one who I would hang with.
Yeah.
So that's my feeling about Cliff. Great guy. And I sad, very sad.
Right.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, there's not a lot of stories you either read or with people we've talked to that knew Cliff, even when, you know, obviously having we had Ray Burton on the show before he passed, and you never hear anything bad about Cliff Burton. It's like he had this aura about him that everyone loved him, and he seemed like he cared about like just so much life. And whether that was you or your daughter, reading her lullabies before bed, just seemed like such a great, kind soul.
He always had a shit-eating grin. You know, he always had his bass strapped to his side. He was always playing riffs. What can I say? You know, what can I say? He was just one really wonderful guy. He really was. Not because he's immortalized or anything. It's just because he was a wonderful guy.
What a cool thing that he was able to be in your house and especially Kill 'Em All. So let's talk about Kill 'Em All. So how did Paul Curcio come to be? You basically say to the boys, I want to manage you. You're killer. Let's make an album. And you created Megaforce for Kill 'Em All, right? For Metallica's debut album. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So they probably would have worked with any producer you brought in. So did you know Paul Curcio? What's the connection with him?
Well, I had done shows with Manowar, and I became close to Joey and Ross the Boss. And Joey and Ross the Boss, believe it or not, you may know of them. They're pretty rugged to talk to. But they were great with me, you know? Everybody was okay with me. There were no facades, no nothing. And Ross produced the Soldiers of Metal record for Anthrax.
Right.
And I liked and respected his ability to do that job. And I was speaking to the two of them about studios and where could I go when I got no money? And what could I do? And who could do a metal album and make it sound like metal in the United States?
Right.
You know, who has recorded the proper metal record? I mean, if you think about it, nobody.
It didn't really exist in America.
No. And when we went into the studio, I had a guy who worked with guitar players. He worked with Santana and the Doobie Brothers, whatever it was.
Right.
He had a bit of a name. I got a producer who worked with Manowar and knew at least that heavy was coming. And we went in the studio. It was up to the band to provide the sound. I went there night after night after night when they were mixing the Kill 'Em All album. And they had Van Halen up to reference.
Which album? Do you remember which album?
Yeah, the first. And it was headache after headache. But eventually we got what we got. And I knew we couldn't come home with a record that wasn't sonically better than the demos. Because between you and me, every fan, their ear knew what the demo sounded like already. And those people, I had to convert from the demo to the vinyl.
Right, of course.
And I had to be better. And it had to sound better. You just put on Hit the Lights and you know this is a great album.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Just absolutely. Man.
So that's the story. And Curcio had no big background. Nobody had a big background. It was all just by the seat of your pants, you know?
It's such a tough question to answer, maybe, but all these years later, it's like, did you guys have a sense in that room getting the playbacks, or maybe the first time you heard a test pressing of the master, a sense that you were, I mean, almost inventing thrash metal as we know it, like doing something really special?
Well, we knew this was fresh.
It was new, yeah, right.
It was new. But remember something. We were working with Raven.
Mm-hmm.
We were working with Anvil. We were very aware of Motorhead. So, you know, we knew about Holocaust and Angel Witch. So we just were molding this to be the American leader, actually the leader of America in that sound, but to be part of the British Euro network of metal bands.
Right.
Based in America.
What was going on the East Coast, like local East Coast?
You just had Anthrax and Overkill.
That's it, yeah.
Nothing much.
Right. It was such a new
sound. They
weren't
getting it.
We've talked a lot about on the show about thrash being this really cool blend of all that new wave of British heavy metal that you've talked about, loving all that stuff, with that punk rock aesthetic that you also talked about, bringing in the Motorhead right into that and the punk rock. It was just right, such a new sound in 81 and 82 and 83.
Yes, it was, and that was the purpose.
You helped bring it to us, dude. It's crazy.
Well, let me tell you something. I wouldn't have it any other way.
So neither would we.
So let's get from... So Kill 'Em All comes out, and you've also got Raven. And they have their, we have the Kill 'Em All for One tour, right? The famous Kill 'Em All for One tour.
That's right.
So that was Metallica's really their first time to see the country in that way.
Oh, yeah.
And they were sharing kind of, it wasn't even a bus, was it? It was like a Winnebago type thing?
I put Metallica through the tortures of the damned. And they rose to every occasion.
Yeah, yeah, they were hungry.
Yeah.
They were hungry and they were killers. And they went out on stage and they just ripped. They just went out and killed every night.
What kind of venues was that tour? And like, what was the average audience cap? Was it like a couple of hundred kids, 500 kids?
Well, you know, we did 500s, 200s, 300s, 100s, 80s, 800s in Chicago. We sold out the theater there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the famous Metro show?
Yeah, the Metro show. Fantastic. Yeah.
I was there for that. That was amazing.
You were there, yeah. Huh?
Oh, yeah. I was announced. I announced the band on the stage. I cut myself out of the video.
Kirk trying to like let the fans play his guitar a little bit, and then taking his guitar is one of my favorite videos of all of Metallica history. When the fans just take that guitar, dude, it's hilarious.
He goes, "He took my guitar."
Yeah, yeah.
He gave him my guitar. He didn't realize what he did.
So you were doing what a lot of great managers do. You were hopping out on the road and maybe carving out a couple of shows you would go to, then maybe you'd go back home. Or were you on the whole tour?
No. I did exactly what you just said. I ended up from Chicago. I went to the California shows when they had a bunch of shows before California. I did the coast, which was amazing. And what was amazing was that Raven were amazing in those days. They still are, but they were like magical, amazing, able to stand up to Metallica. It was a great package.
Was Raven headlining or was it a co-headline?
No, it was a headline Raven.
Yeah, right. So Metallica's opening for Raven's nuts.
Well, remember, I put out the Metallica album. It had sold maybe 7,000 to 12,000. And Raven was at like 27,000.
Okay.
And are you shipping, at this point, are you shipping all those albums or did you have a distributor?
I had a distributor.
Okay.
That had to have been, I'd imagine, a bit of a tough tour to promote because back in those days, thrash metal's new. I think you talk about in your book, there was only, what, 6 radio stations across the country that would play Kill 'Em All?
Yeah.
So that had to have been tough to promote, especially in like Midwestern towns, maybe in the South, stuff like that.
It was murder, man. It was absolute murder. If they didn't know what it was, the kids in the area, you couldn't reach them to get the word out.
Yeah.
If there was enough kid, once you got the word out, people would come. Like Chicago, they knew what they were expecting.
Because they had the album or they had the demo, they had No Life to Leather, had reached those parts of the world or?
They had everything.
Yeah, they'd already heard it. It was coming.
Yeah, and then we made a video there. I paid for a video. And that became the Kill 'Em All. And I don't know what happened to the Raven. You know, I just don't remember.
Why'd you said you cut yourself out of it? Because it's missing like the first 10 or 15 minutes, right?
Yeah, I don't know what happened. Could I tell you, it was a real clusterfuck that night. They stole James's pedals and, oh man, it was horrible.
Yeah, interesting. The fans did?
Somebody came in the back door and took his stuff.
Wow.
That sucks. Jeez.
You know, and it wasn't like he had money to get a new one, you know?
What were they like off the stage? Because, as you know, John and Ethan and I are both touring musicians professionally. Some of it's a big party. Some of it's just real boring. Some of there's just not a lot to do. You walk around, you go to coffee shops, you go to record stores.
Now, life was very interesting around Metallica.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just say that. They were like the Ever-Ready. Or the Duracell rabbit. I don't know which one's the rabbit. But they just kept on going.
Right. Yeah. The Energizer bunnies.
Energizer bunny. They're just like a bunch of Energizer bunnies.
So they probably made their own fun wherever they were, I imagine.
Well, you know, I'm a little older than them. And I was there for everything they needed. But I wasn't there to go party with them and carry on because I couldn't keep up with them, first of all.
Well, you also had a ship to steer, essentially. You know, you're... going back to your DIY mentality, I mean, you're putting money into filming the Metro show. I believe in your book, you mentioned you took out a second mortgage on your house to help fund Kill 'Em All.
Well, I took out a second mortgage on my house in two banks.
But so that,
I took out two loans for 13 each.
Wow.
But it's going back to that, you know, that Johnny Z mentality. You got to do what you got to do because you believe in it. You're passionate about it. You saw something in this band, and you'll do whatever you have to do to keep that ship moving. And
I believed so much.
It's amazing.
I believed. I saw it. What is today? I saw through my eyes.
Right, right. You saw what it could be, the Metallica we see
now. I saw the whole thing.
So after that tour, were the records starting to fly off? Were you starting to really notice?
Well, things were taking off, yeah.
So then, is this at the point in the story when Elektra comes knocking and you got to figure out this
next
step?
Well, what happened is that everybody was on my ass all of a sudden for Metallica when nobody wanted Metallica. But the deals for the future Ride the Lightning were so stupid and so moronic that I couldn't make a deal because they would have hurt the band's future because I felt they were so much more than the way they were being looked at. They were being looked at like an indie deal, and I was looking at this like a, how could I explain it? Like a Frampton comes alive or
right.
something.
Like, right. like a real arena act, a high-selling act.
Right. So we couldn't meet on that. And then I had gone to a Largo about a Megaforce deal. And in the conversations, we talked about Metallica. And for some reason, I mean, Michael and I are great buddies now. But for some reason, he never wanted to do a deal with me in it.
So make it Elektra exclusive.
Right. He didn't want the Megaforce around.
Well, and okay. I want to make sure I get the timeline right, too. You'd already recorded Lightning, right? The 7 Days of Hell tour, taking them through Copenhagen.
Lightning was not out yet.
But it had been recorded.
The demo may have been floating of the advance.
Gotcha.
Okay.
And so that's when Alago's like, hey, we want to put it out. Elektra is going to have a bigger reach or whatever, which is great for you if they want to make a deal that includes you. But I guess there was some back and forth on that part.
I thought that it did between you and me for a while. And I was, you know, look, it's common knowledge. It didn't have a happy ending at the Roseland Ballroom where I had everybody come together and do the greatest showcase of three bands for an independent label.
Yeah.
Eventually Raven got a deal, Anthrax got a deal, and Metallica right up front got a deal. But the deal did not include me, and they had already seen other managers, and that was it. That's the end of the story.
Because you were hoping at the very least, even if they went with Elektra, they would still stick with you as a manager.
Absolutely. It was my journey with them that I was hoping for.
Yeah.
That's exactly correct. No more Megaforce, at least management. But you want it, that's the way it happened with Anthrax. We just kept the Megaforce logo. But yeah. I just managed Anthrax and went on to do that for 11 years.
Amazing.
There were things I can't discuss now.
Yeah, sure.
Or ever. That's not going to be in the book.
Of course.
But there were lots of things that led up to the parting. I'll leave it at that.
Sure, man.
You know, it took years for us to become great friends again.
Which I know is the case, right? Because you're sort of, I've heard tales of you spotted at Metallica shows on the Hardwired tour, et cetera. And
why not? Why am I going to miss a good show?
Right.
Exactly. And how about, I mean, Ethan and I talk about this. We saw the boys several times on the last tour, and even when they play those Kill 'Em All songs in a stadium of 50,000 people playing Seek and Destroy, and it still works, it still kills, it still translates, it's still powerful. You know?
Yeah. And when I was out in Orlando, they dedicated it to me, which was very nice.
Yeah.
Amazing.
You know, they always say something nice if I'm in the audience. And it is what it is, you know?
Sure.
They were very good to me over the years and still are. And that's the way it is. I don't get into the business ends of things, but life was fair in the end.
Well, and we, you know, us included, I mean, everyone in the Metallica universe knows that, you know, there wouldn't be a Metallica on Elektra or with Q Prime or whatever. There wouldn't be the Metallica we know today if you weren't involved at the get-go. Just like I said before, steering that ship and just putting your heart and soul into this band. And, you know, you say in the book, you think that, you know, they would have still become superstars, but I think that initial push and drive you had is a massive reason that kind of helped catapult them on that upward bound career, you know?
Well, there was tons of energy in the retro boosters, in the rocket ship, you know? There was a lot of fuel in those early stages that propelled it where it has to go. And what Elektra told me in a meeting later on was that basically they had nothing to do. They just had to put the records out and feed the beast.
Right.
Because there wasn't even much work.
The breaking of the band nobody heard of was all done.
Speaking about, you know, feeding the beast, I mean, there wasn't hardly any time between touring Kill 'Em All and going into writing and recording Ride the Lightning, right? It was just like the machine had to keep going at that point.
Well, 1 year.
The Kill 'Em All for One tour was just that one tour, right? It was kind of through the States one time.
Yeah.
And took however long. And then it was time to, yeah, make a new album. But, you know, just looking at the resume and what Megaforce would go on to do even after that, it's like the Rocket Boosters were massive for that, too. I mean, I'm looking now at, like, obviously Overkill, Anthrax, Ministry, Fraley's Comet, Ace Frehley, Testament.
Yeah.
King's X. I mean, some amazing bands and records.
Well, we didn't want to let the letdown of the Roseland Ballroom stop us. It just gave me more time and energy to put in the record company, which became huge. I didn't have to give 20 hours a day to Metallica, 1 half hour to Anthrax, 1 half hour to Raven. You know, it was all free. So everything worked out pretty much, you know.
When you were on the road with the boys over in Europe, like you said, you were hanging out with Cliff the day before he was killed in the bus accident.
Yeah.
So you're obviously over there working day to day with Anthrax at that point, but you're still sort of mingling through the Metallica camp. So I'm guessing by then it was all cool and it was just fun to be out on tour.
No. We were first feeling each other out for the first time.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
It was our first real get together. It's just that Cliff and I were together like it was never, like nothing ever happened.
What were you guys doing on the road just to hang out? Would you guys go to record stores or go to like pubs or?
Oh, I don't know. I don't remember. I usually went to record companies and had meetings about press and where they're having dinner tonight and what they're doing for press before the show and making sure everything is moving right and catering is right. And I had all those things on my mind. I don't worry about what the country looks like.
Well, so, John, we're going to move into the last part here. We don't want to take up too much of your time. Obviously, so grateful that you are hanging out with us. Our listeners are going to absolutely love hearing from you. We have this All thing right. called Patreon where we have people who support the show and we let them ask our guests like you questions. And we got a ton of questions for you if you're down to answer some of these from some listeners.
Let's see. Let's do a few.
Yeah, let's do a few and see what happens.
I'm going to skip the first one because it has to do with the firing of Dave Mustaine, which you kind of already explained. The question was there any management involvement in the firing of Dave Mustaine? But we kind of went through that already.
And remember, the answer is really no.
A patron named Jay Middleton says, "Hey John, do you seek out any new music for fun? And has there been any newer artists that you've seen that gave you that same feeling when you first saw or heard Metallica?"
Nobody has given me the Metallica Ride the Lightning vibe. Nobody. In the non-metal world, I managed the band that I left because it was in my head to leave.
Yeah.
They didn't fire me. I just couldn't do it anymore. And the band was called the Disco Biscuits.
Yeah.
They're not heavy metal, but when they're on, they're intense on stage.
Right.
That's about it. King's X has moved me. King's X has moved me. And Testament at times really knocked my socks off. Right. But today, if you ask me, like, what do I listen to get my rocks off? I really love, like, Arch Enemy.
Oh, they're great, yeah.
You know, and I like Amon Amarth. That's sort of where my head's at right now.
Okay.
Here's an interesting question I have always wondered. I'm glad that this person asked this. Christian Poe says, "Did you have any part in the change of the title from Metal Up Your Ass to Kill 'Em All?"
Well, I was sitting there when it happened.
Were you the guy saying, we can't sell this with a dagger and a toilet, calling it Metal Up Your Ass?
I was saying the distribution will not sell it under these conditions.
Okay. And then the famous story is Cliff talking about, quote unquote, the man, the distributor, whomever, said just kill them all. And that's kind of how it happened.
Well, he was wearing a Green Beret shirt that said, kill them all, let God sort them out at the time. Just in case anybody doesn't know.
Okay. I've never
heard
that.
If they don't know, they found out here because I never told anybody, but that's what he was wearing. So he just said, kill them all.
Amazing. And hey, the rest is history. Good. Sometimes it's funny when like a quick joke can actually turn into the best idea of the night.
Bobby Anand asks, what's your favorite album that you released as part of Megaforce Records?
Believe it or not, I'm going to say Kill 'Em All.
I believe you. I believe it.
We believe you.
And he also asked, are there any regrets on bands that you passed on signing, that you could have signed but passed on?
I have no regrets on Pantera and Rob Zombie, because at the time I was involved with Ministry and my management career was really taking off, and we were in the middle of Lollapalooza and 3 million sales. So I just have no regrets. I was just too busy.
Let's see. Namarta says, oh, this is nice, John. She says, I don't have a question, but I just wanted to express my appreciation. Thank you for believing in Metallica and helping them get to where they are today. Well, that's nice.
Cool.
Another one of those, Jesse House. No question in particular. Hopefully we get some good discussion about Anthrax. Oh, Anthrax in the early days. Any tidbits about Anthrax in the early days? With a lot of, obviously, crossover fans who love both bands so much.
Well, I'm going to say, please get the audio book.
Oh, there's great stories in
the book, because there's tons about Anthrax.
I
just don't want to go into it all now. But if you love Anthrax, this book is for you.
I love Anthrax, and I was absolutely digging the Anthrax stories. No spoilers, but if you haven't gotten the book or audiobook yet, get it. There's a great bit about Scott Ian and demo tapes. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, right on. Hey, I love the answer, get the book. That's what we're here to promote anyway.
Get the book.
Which, again, we are going to be giving away 2 copies of the audiobook, thanks to John and his publisher. Here's the last question. This is about New Jersey. This will be helpful for anyone who lives up there. It says, Brian King says, when passing through Old Bridge, New Jersey, what landmarks can people visit to remember the old scene?
First of all, I don't know if you could see my shirt.
Old Bridge Militia Foundation. All right, tell us about that.
The Old Bridge. Well, it's the militia. It is the metal militia. But what I will say is that if you ever go down Route 516, there's a club there. It's a strip bar. And that used to be the hangout, the Club 516. It's right in an area of Old Bridge called Browntown. And in that club, Metallica spent many a night. Venom spent many a night. More bands than you could ever imagine were in there, air guitaring with us and headbanging to all the early metal as it was coming out.
Amazing.
And that 516 still stands, except it's a titty bar now.
Just take some disinfectant and enjoy the memories.
Right. What about the brick and mortar where your record store was after you left the flea market? Is that still standing?
No, they knocked down the flea market.
What about the location you did after that?
I think it's a hair salon.
Okay, maybe we should go to that hair salon in New Jersey and bring in some old boom boxes, blasting Kill 'Em All, and see what happens.
By the way, it's done all the time. It's done all the time. The bathroom in that Rock and Roll Heaven was signed by every band you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
With their deepest and most bizarre thoughts. The entire, I'm talking Slayer, Metallica, Anthrax, you name it, it was in there.
What about the house? What about the house you and Marcia shared that you mortgaged to pay for Kill 'Em All, that all these bands stayed
in? Worth a bit of money now. It stands, it's beautiful. People go by. The guy is a real hater of metal.
What?
A real I was just about to ask about the guy. And he'll chase you out of there with a shotgun.
Wow.
Which itself is kind of metal, ironically.
Why not?
It's just interesting. I think about that kind of stuff often when it comes to either like famous spots like that have so much music history, or maybe a popular filming location from a TV show. You know, if you ended up purchasing a home that was used in something that people continually show up, I feel like it's just wasted energy to keep running people away. You're going to do that as long as you own the house. And if you sell it, the next guy's going to have to do it too. I say embrace it. Make it a tourist destination. Be like, oh, yeah. You want to see where they slept?
That house could have been a museum.
Mm, yeah.
You know, sure. It definitely could have. But it's not. Some mean guy lives there.
We will use our powers for good and try to... We'll try to figure out what we can do about the mean shotgun guy that hates metal. Hey, John, thank you so much for your time. What a truly, honestly, truly an honor to speak with you. And thank you. I know our listeners will feel the same way.
Absolutely.
The book's killer. We're grateful that we were able to speak and chat with you. So hopefully our paths will cross again down the line.
Hey, listen, guys, I'm surprised I never ran into you before. We could have done a lot. We'll do some more in the future. All right.
Well, there you go. What a sweetie pie.
Oh, my gosh. He's such an awesome guy, man. John Zazula. It's still kind of mind-blowing that we got to chat with him and how easy that came to be and getting contacted by his publicist and stuff. And just to be able to sit down for a little while and chat with somebody that's such an integral part of the birth of American thrash metal is just such an honor.
I agree. And it was a treat. It's also an honor, my friend, just to see you, to be in your presence.
Hello. Yes, of course.
Might I say it also honors me to be here?
It does. It absolutely does, mate.
All right. Well, here's the deal. You got homework out there, which, by the way, let's go ahead and just say this. Next week, we have another amazing guest, but we're not going to tell you who it is. You need to go follow us on the socials if you want to find out. Honey, please. It's a little game we play.
It's so easy.
But we do have another amazing guest next week that I'm really excited to talk to. I think you guys are going to love it as well. Your homework is to leave us the positive review on iTunes if you got a second. And of course, if you are willing and able, if you think Metal Up Your Podcast has value, if it's a podcast you listen to, it makes you laugh, it brings you joy. It brings you knowledge about Metallica.
I love joy.
I love joy. I love knowledge. The right thing. You know what the right thing is. Go get on Patreon train. Go get supportive over there. And by the way, if you don't or can't, we still love you.
We do.
And with that, we will say, have a good week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your families. Peace.
Adios. Hey, everyone. This is Ethan and Clint. We're here to tell you about supporting the show via Patreon.
That's right. Every week, Ethan and I work hard to bring you the best Metallica content possible. If you think the show has value, consider supporting us on a financial level at Patreon.
For $5 a month, or the price of 2 cups of coffee, you can ensure that Metal Up Your Podcast continues to grow in quality and content. But that's not all.
In addition to being able to help sleep at night for supporting your favorite podcast, we've also come up with incentives to say thank you that are exclusively available to patrons. For example, for a pledge of $5 or more, you immediately get free downloads of every Cover Our World Blackened EP.
Ticket giveaways for shows like SNM2 and Slain Castle.
Box sets, rare vinyl, Metallica memorabilia like SNM2 guitar picks.
Email priority, meaning we'll read your email first on the show with a chance to ask guests like Hailstorm, Jay Weinberg of Slipknot, and Metallica Road Crew your very own questions.
And the opportunity to come on the show as a guest for our Metal Tales bonus episodes in which you can tell us all about any Metallica show you've been to in the past.
All this and more for becoming a patron and supporting Metal Up Your Podcast.
We couldn't do this show without you, and to everyone on the ride with us, we sincerely thank you. Peace.
Adios.
If you were our advisor, what would you say? Then I would say, delete that.